It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. David Bowie released a new CD this year called Heathen over the summer in celebration of the 30th anniversary of his glam rock classic The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. An expanded version of the Ziggy album was reissued on CD and the film played in theaters. Ziggy was one of Bowie's early gender-bending alter egos, mixing androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair bright red. Even before Ziggy, Bowie posed on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. In his early career, each album seemed to find Bowie in a different persona, with a new sound to match his new look. That character-driven part of his career ended years ago, but he still inhabited different characters in his movie roles. I spoke with Bowie last summer. We started with a song from Heathen called Afraid.
I wish I was smarter. I got so lost on the shore.
Do you have an alter ego to go with this particular CD?
Nope.
Is having an alter ego less important to you than it used to be?
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975, for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad, maybe one too many characters, but had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around, and you're known by the, you're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about, and that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff and I kind of I guess I, you know, a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now at the age of 55 than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and being when you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses,
yeah,
when you wanted
that
to?
Was for, that was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which, out of a career of nearly 40 years, is not very long. However, yeah. I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience. That
can
really
I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance and who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favourite thing to do. I don't, as I say, I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well. But I really do rather want to move on because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on the, on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
No, before you became David Bowie, when you were playing with other bands before forming your own, did you do the denim thing? You know, did you wear a t-shirt and jeans on stage?
Very, very rarely, actually. No, it wasn't really something that I. Because I never believed it. It always felt like you were trying too hard to look like the audience or something. That whole thing about the artistic integrity, which, of course, I've never bought into with any artist. It's just not a real thing.
Wait, so let me stop you and see if I got this straight. Wearing a T-shirt and jeans seemed phony to you, but wearing mascara and eye makeup seemed right.
I didn't say that wearing a glamorization of the rock artist was any truer.
Oh, okay, right. It's artifice, but it's an artifice that you believe in. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think my main point would be is that the T-shirt and denims thing, in my mind, was also an artifice.
Right.
I didn't feel comfortable in that because I didn't feel like one of the working men. I mean, I could never be a blue-collar-y, kind of Springsteen-y type artist because I don't believe I am that. And I don't believe I could ever represent that. And it is merely representation.
Well, getting back to Ziggy, the story of Ziggy Stardust is a story of someone who becomes very famous. It's the story of rock and roll fame. Becomes very famous, and then fame becomes his downfall. He's kind of killed in a way by fame. What did that fable that you created mean to you at the time? Is that the way you saw rock and
roll?
Well,
I can only really look at it the way I look at it now, which is, I think, independently of myself, Ziggy Stardust has his own life. He's his own creation, and you know what? Good luck to him. But frankly, for me, I kind of closed the door on him in 1973, and I'm very happy that he's having such success and that people still like him and all that. I heard he got married. Anyway, I personally have another life, which doesn't belong to Ziggy Stardust, and I do tend to not really get that involved in what I've done in the past. I do kind of leave that up to other people, and that's much how I feel about Ziggy. I kind of prefer the audience and maybe writers or commentators or whatever, to make what they will of the Ziggy Stardust period and character, because it actually doesn't interest me much now.
David Bowie recorded last summer. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show as our encore week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Encore Week on Fresh Air, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Let's get back to the interview with David Bowie, which we first broadcast last September. Here's Bowie's 1971 hit Changes. As rock critic Ken Tucker wrote in the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, in the face of the hippie era's sincerity, intimacy, and generosity, Bowie presented irony, distance, and self-absorption. His song Changes announced the arrival of a new counterculture.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild in me in dead end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes. Turn and face the strain. changes. Don't wanna be a richer man. To be a different man, thou may change me, but I can't trace time.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. So I got my father to help me out with a saxophone, and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you pay 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto. And then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything just because you opened your mouth and sang. But really, I guess, but no, I really wanted to do more than anything else up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music?
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. And it kind of, because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on. And I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
So when you say you wanted to write musicals, did you want to write, like, Rodgers and Hart kind of musicals or Hair? I mean, what...
No, that was my point. No, yeah. My point was I wanted to rewrite how rock music was perceived.
Oh, I
and
see.
And I
yeah,
thought
right.
that I could do some kind of vehicle involving rock musicals
right.
and presenting rock and characters and storyline in a completely different fashion.
So was singing something you started doing to... So that you could do that kind of theatre?
It was, it was the conception that, I mean, God, I would love to have handed it on to somebody else, and I guess Ziggy would have been the perfect vehicle to have done with. I don't know why, to this day, I didn't find some other kid after I'd done it for like 6 months and said, ew, I'll put the wig on and send him out and do the gigs, you know? I mean, it would have been much the best thing to do, and then I could have moved on quicker to something else. But that comes back to what... I was saying I needed to sing because nobody else was singing my songs.
Right.
So I had to do it myself.
You were briefly in a mime group before...
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah. It all kind of ran... I tended to be... I seem to be kind of involved in so many things all at the same time, which is still how I kind of operate today. I can't keep my fingers out of any pies.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through that mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets.
Mm-hmm.
He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
While we're on the subject of mime, I have to mention that in the Ziggy movie, you do those hands walking across the glass wall thing.
I know. That's my proudest moment of the Ziggy Stardust movie.
The dreaded mime thing.
Yeah. Well, meme over meme here, is. Isn't it? I know. It's so utterly abhorred over here. We didn't know that in England because we love it over there. And it broke our hearts when we came over here and realized that memes were kind of tantamount to some kind of artistic criminals.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie recorded last summer after the release of his CD, Heathen. This is Fresh Air.